The Serious TV Drama Podcast. I'm Scott, and joining me tonight, the Antune to my macaroon, it's Brian. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Scott. How you doing tonight?
I am doing okay. Still healing here, you know, but, you know. And I could tell you about all the rather horrific misadventures I've had this past week that only some of which involve the foot. They're all funny, but they all make me look bad, and they deserve a podcast on their own. All I'll say is that they on separate occasions they involve either, you know, a few involve a certain cat and his bowel movements and an unexpected large bug. And also, then said cat got underfoot, literally, and somebody tripped really bad, really bad, like had to take the last Percocet bad. So it hasn't been as much fun as one would have liked it to be. I haven't just been home just watching, you know, binge watching TV and whatnot. But beyond that, I'm still feeling a little echo of pain from the cat underfoot falling I did yesterday. But beyond that, I think I'm doing all right. So I was more than ready to watch what we are going to be talking about this evening, which, of course, is the latest episode of Fargo. I believe this is the sixth episode of the season, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, I believe it's six.
And the episode was titled Camp Elegance. I did not make... Although I didn't make a note of it, I think I saw it at the end credits. I'm assuming there's another Noah Hawley written episode, because I think...
I did not pay attention because I quickly switched over to the World Series, and I should have, but I didn't.
I know it was the Dana person was the director. I noticed that. Was it person we spoke about in a previous podcast. I forget the name. It's like Dana Gonzalez or something like that. I apologize if I didn't. We're trying to get this one done really fast for you guys. So you're not coming here to hear who wrote and directed it unless we have something special to say about it. And one thing I know, that the same people who wrote and directed this episode have written and directed a previous episode or so. So we've already talked about them. So we can just get right to the episode. Now, the title was Camp Elegance, but it could have easily been called the life and death of, you know, Antune Domini, or Antune Domini, we hardly knew ya. Because at the end of the day, it's funny. Perhaps one of the pitfalls of having a season, every season of Fargo is like this to some extent, but a pitfall of having such a huge ensemble cast is, if we haven't spent much time with a character in the previous, I guess for this in this situation, the previous five episodes, it's hard to get much of an attachment and therefore to quote-unquote care about what happens to a character in the sixth episode. Although, they came close. I thought they did as decent a job as they could have. But if you had asked me at any point during the previous five episodes, hey, which guy's Antune? I'm like, well, I don't know. I don't know. He had appeared in other episodes, but I couldn't have told you what his name was. I couldn't have told you anything about him other than he was just one of the many Fada lackeys that we'd see from time to time. So, I'll give him credit for working hard and even the actor doing some stuff there that made you kind of care about him at the very end, and thus his tragic end having kind of an impact in that sense. But it probably would have landed harder if we had gotten to know him a little bit more in the previous few episodes.
Yeah, I think Rabbi Milligan was basically like the writers. He was the proxy for the writers when he just whacked him. because, you know, we have a lot of we have a lot of talented players that, because this cast is so big, almost are like background players. It kind of reminded me of The Office, where you have the episode where someone has to be fired and all of a sudden Devin comes into Michael's office. And, you know, you saw Devin a couple of times in the background, but he never really had much of a presence on the show at all.
Right.
And so this guy, who's sort of been a background player for the most part, is brought in, and big credit to him. I mean, he gives a very credible, very good performance, and they quickly set up, you know, that he, being a foot soldier, has a lot more heart, and isn't as Machiavellian about it. And maybe even at the end, in some ways, wants to believe in the American dream, right. More so, and has made more of that switch from immigrant to citizen. So I mean, it was a nice storyline, but like you say, I mean, we only had so much invested in him, but was one of the, I will call out this week, this was a short episode. There were three things I noticed that we'll talk about, but this was the first of three explicit Coen Brothers nods that the scene with him and Satchel and eventually Rabbi Milligan was very reminiscent to me of Miller's Crossing.
Absolutely.
The faraway shot where he raises the gun, you know, I thought was an obvious homage to Miller's Crossing. One of three, at least. I'm sure there were more, but one of three homages to the Coen Brothers I caught in this.
Right. Yeah, and we've been down that path before, the nod to Miller's Crossing. You know, it kind of takes us back a little bit to season two, when they take her out, you know, in the woods to be shot. It had that same kind of feeling to it. And of course, one can reference other things that we've seen that in as well, but I always think, to a certain extent, they're lifting from Miller's Crossing. I mean, The Sopranos did that, but they did it in a way which I thought also recalled Miller's Crossing. Because Miller's Crossing was, it may not be as talked about a gangster movie the way, say, you know, The Godfather or Goodfellas is, but regardless, regardless of it being a period piece, it still is fairly influential, because, you know, it was the Coen Brothers really, you know, at the top of their game, and one could say before they, even though I guess Raising Arizona was around, you know, within the same year or two, but the Coen Brothers didn't get quite as, I'm gonna say, not quite as goofy. They weren't quite as full of themselves as they could get with later projects, where they might have veered towards a bit more self-indulgence than I think was warranted at times. Still enjoyable movies, but I couldn't help but think, maybe they need to rein it in a little bit here. You know, maybe they're just going a little bit too cartoony here, but whatever. But that certainly wasn't the case with Miller's Crossing. But yeah, I mean, it was interesting because you think of this guy, you know, when you first see him, like, oh, he's just, again, like, perfect, like a background character or whatever. But then when you notice that when he's home, his, you know, his wife and kids are there, they're in the same house, I'm thinking, oh, he's a bigger deal, I think. I mean, is he also related, even though he doesn't share the same last name? Is he like a brother-in-law or something? I'm not really sure. Because it is interesting that his wife and kids would all be there. So, and I'm assuming that's not the case with all the guys. So that means he's probably a few rungs higher than them, I would assume. But again, it's the first time we're seeing this, like, oh God, he's got a wife and kids and they're all there. And she's, you know, hoping he's going to move up whenever. And oh, by the way, once he saw that happening with his wife, I was already like, oh, you're doing this just so you're going to kill him. Because, right, you know, however it goes, I feel that was what was going to happen. And there's nothing more tragic than the fact that, you know, in that last moment, he changes his mind, but apparently the rabbi doesn't see it that way from behind him, either doesn't realize or doesn't care. And he's almost literally killed, you know, seconds after he decides not to kill the kid. So it makes you go, oh, but he was going to do the right thing. Oh, isn't that always the way with these kind of TV shows?
Yeah, I it's sad, but I think at that point, Rabbi Milligan can't, nobody can be left alive that knows that he's got the kid and they're gone. And
oh yeah, you're, you know, right. Absolutely.
Like
right.
He's And as sad as it is, you know, I was really sympathetic towards her, and they did a great turn right at the end where she sort of looks at him with that look like, oh, that's what's going to happen. And, you know, she blesses herself, does the sign of the cross. And, you know, then she knows that they're going to kill him. And, you know, it was a good scene. He and Josto, when he obviously is trying every way possible not to be told to do that. But at the end of the day, he's going to do it. But I think what the subtext of this whole scene was, is that maybe more so than almost anyone else, that the American dream, the family, the kids, I mean, the kids are watching a Western on TV when he comes in the house, that maybe of all the people he has to do this, this guy's the most changed by the American experience. And when he even says, when he's in the camp, you know, that I saw this beautiful sun and the smell of the food and things brought me back. And it's really sad that he talks about how beautiful the sun was, and he's killed on a cloudy day,
right?
With, you know, no sun shining, and you know, so I mean, it is sad, and the story of it was nice, and it's sort of like he was maybe the most integrated person in the group, but at the end of the day, he still was, you know, at least contemplating killing a kid.
And, right. I mean, he was a foot soldier looking to move up, and if you're going to pursue the American dream, that's kind of what you have to do. But it's interesting distinguishing, you know, all these people from the quote unquote old country originally, and his very different perspective on America and the American dream compared to say Gaetano, who's basically spitting on it.
Right. Or Calamita.
Or Calamita, who's even worse. Well, I don't know if I say worse. Yeah, he's worse because he's just like, you know, I think he's just a little scumbag. So
I think he's worse because he's smarter than Gaetano.
Right.
In many ways, but he's more dastardly. He would play things to stab somebody in the back. The one thing about Gaetano, he is smart and he's shrewd, but at some point he comes at somebody head on. He doesn't shoot him in the back like Calamito did Dr. Senator.
Right. And also, yeah. And Gaetano's upfront about what he is and what he wants, whereas Calamita is, as you say, dastardly. You know, he's a liar. Gaetano generally doesn't lie. He basically just says what he thinks because he wants to take over. And he's not really pussyfooting around about it.
Yeah, and talking about Gaetano, because he plays a big part in this, that is an interesting characteristic of him, that even when confronted by Loy, no matter what happens with Gaetano, he may not come out and say what he's done, and he may move behind someone's back, but when the you know, truth comes out, he doesn't deny it. He, you know, he embraces it, and so much so that you know, he laughs in Loy's face. So I mean, not that Gaetano is more honorable. He's just a different kind of animal than Calamita. And, you know, and it's funny, I thought the way they chained him up was almost to make him look like, you know, he was a rabid dog. And
right.
To put the you know, the collar around his neck was striking imagery of Gaetano in that scene.
Absolutely. It's interesting when you think of like Gaetano and Calamita, because, you know, I would, if I was going to use animal analogies or metaphors or what have you, I feel like Gaetano is basically a bull and he's going to come right at you. Whereas Calamita is more, he's more of like a jackal, and he's kind of, you know, he's waiting on the sidelines. He's finding his little, he's finding his ways in, and he'll attack here and there, but also hide and whatever. I have a feeling his eventual death will be quite satisfying, and we won't be disappointed by it. The overall episode, and why it's, and probably one of the reasons it feels so quick, it's basically we're just pinballing back and forth between Loy and Josto, pretty much quick accelerating things, making their moves, because they are clearly, whether they want to or not, they're going to war at this point. And I don't think there's any denying that that's going to change because of, you know, any kind of misunderstandings, whatever. I mean, once they kill Dr. Senator, regardless of the fact that, because Loy does not care which brother was the one behind it, it's still them. They're still behind it, you know. And I think that was like the straw that broke the camel's back, as far as I can see. So he just wants to get his boy out of there. But beyond that, I think he just wants to lay them to waste and take over at this point. And meanwhile, although done more comically, Jasta's kind of trying to reassure himself that he's got the backing of New York, because he's kind of fighting a war on two fronts between what's going on with his brother as well as the Cannons. So you got to give Jasta credit to a certain degree that he's trying to kill two birds with one stone. He's probably trying to do things to, like, okay, this will help him, you know, get rid of Gaetano and also get one up on Loy and eventually finish them off, since New York will have to back him no matter what. Whether he's right about that remains to be seen. But it was just interesting seeing Jasta starting to, like, really be calculating and make moves, as opposed to the way he was in the first couple episodes, where he seemed to be solely obsessed with, like, killing off a doctor who kind of wronged them by not letting them in their hospital and stuff.
Yeah, and you don't see him seemingly under the influence of substances. He seems at his, you know, to have his wits about him.
Right.
The whole episode, and is calculating things on the fly. I did like the scene where Ebal returns from New York and isn't aware Dr. Senator's dead. And you see, like, clearly the consternation on his face when he hears Dr. Senator's dead. And I think it was well played, because it's both he knows that means war, but he also sort of had a grudging respect for Dr. Senator, you know, from their sit downs. And
right.
And we also get, you know, in that scene, a timeline that now we're on a, you know, basically Jasta has 2 weeks to make everything right.
Right. So
we get that, and we get the command to make things right with his brother, and Jasta turns that into an opportunity to try to fix all this at one time, and in a way that seems more competent than we've seen him act so far.
Absolutely. And also the fact that he is clearly aware of what's going on with Kalamita. He knows full well Kalamita was the one who shot him, and that Kalamita has basically has been loyal to his brother, not to him. Because when he says in questioning his loyalties, yeah, he knows. Kalamita may lie, but he's not good at it. So it made me respect the Jasta character a bit more, since before he was either, like you said, you know, under the influence of substance, or just kind of being a bit of a lightweight or goofy. Just like that scene that we talked about in a previous episode, when he goes to see all the guys who are being held in jail, and he's doing really well, and then all of a sudden he kind of goes off the rails a little bit, and is like, oh, you might have lost your footing as being an intimidating presence with that comment or action there. But he certainly does a little bit better here. So even when he's getting frustrated or annoyed with people, it's not to the comical side that we'd seen before. It's just a man being impatient with people who are questioning him, or people whose loyalty he questions. So I'm curious to see, you know, in the next episode or two, if they do, what more they're going to do as far as the Kalamita character, as far as how he's perceived by Jasta and the others. Because there are other men I think Jasta needs to be worrying about, but Kalamita is obviously the main one, as far as the Gaetano loyal men, I would think.
Yeah. Yeah, the one thing that I thought was curious about this episode is they obviously explored Satchel's story, but they didn't explore, you know, the hostage on the other side at all, and curiously omitted that from the story totally, which makes me wonder if that's what next week's episode will be, is how Loy deals with that situation.
Right. Did I mishear a moment there where I got the impression, and you know, correct me if I'm wrong about this, I got the impression that Josta was willing to sacrifice his kid.
I got an impression of that, but it wasn't said explicitly.
Okay.
I think part of his calculation is once Satchel's dead, I mean, you know, what's he going to be able to do? He's not going to be able to storm Lloyd's house and get into Lloyd's house and get the kid, because the house will be protected. But part of his scheming, you know, completely neglects trying to protect his kid. And I think to his organization and the people in New York, you know, they care about family, and obviously they care about his brother, and there are supporters of his brother in New York, we learn. Hmm. that just sacrificing your kid, I don't think will be very favorable to him in you know, the LCN in New York.
Right. I am kind of confused with them, because at this point in the story, at this point in time, I should say, although we saw in, I guess it was the very first or second episode, that Josta was potentially going to be marrying that woman who was the daughter of, you know, the politician, right?
Right.
But Zero, the kid that that's his son.
So that's the way I take it. Yes.
Where's the mom? Is she dead? Have they mentioned? Have I missed something here? Because I guess I have, but I'm just curious about that. It's like, he has a kid. Who do you have the kid with? And why have they made a reference to this? And I'm just not remembering it, which is very possible. My memory ain't what it used to be, kid. So I might just not be remembering something. Or maybe I should have looked it up online before we started recording.
No, but I think that's symptomatic of what the one criticism of this show is, that there are so many pieces, and we've had long episodes, that if all these characters and all these storylines were fleshed out, this would be a 12 episode series. And obviously it was slated for 8, and Holly was given a 9th. And so, I think if there's a criticism, it's that sometimes to move all these pieces on the board, we've lost some bits of information that just had to be cut for time's sake. And so there are little questions and holes in the story that we have. And don't get me wrong, you and I both agree on this. We don't like, storytelling that where it feeds you everything.
Right.
I'm okay with that. But there are some big gaps that aren't filled at times. And it's kind of jarring to have characters pop up that you don't really have a relationship with. Mm-hmm. In the midst of a story. And so if I had a criticism of the show, I think this episode, which I really liked, there were a few moments, like I thought the sort of a passing reference to Zero's made, I think, between Ebal and Josto.
Yes.
There's that passing reference, but to sort of play that off with sort of one line, I think it's probably just a function of the time they have left to do what they have to do. And so that's a minor criticism, but I do think it has, when you have those gaps, sometimes they can just for a moment take you out of the story to wonder what's going on or what's happening,
right,
and why that wasn't dealt with. So,
well, I think that makes perfect sense. By the way, it's going to be an 11 episode season. Just
is it 11?
It's 11, yeah.
Okay, I thought it was 9.
Nope. Some other show we were talking about and recently it turned out to be 9, but not this one. I think it was might have been The Haunting of Bly Manor or something. Should have been 10, only 9 then again. Don't really care because it wasn't that good. No, I kid. It was all right. It was so-so.
So it's supposed to be 10, but it's going to be 11.
Yes, they added one. I felt kind of similar to what you're saying was the situation. to me, looking at it, you know, taking a the writer in me says, okay, we have to at least acknowledge this because the audience will be wondering, well, what about your kid? But I also think it's Holly's way of saying, this isn't that important. I don't want you to be focusing on this. If I'm not focusing on it, then you shouldn't be, because there's a reason why we're not talking about this. Because, you know, all the kid has been there before was that one scene with when Loy goes to the funeral home. And it's done, it's he's there. Whereas Satchel has a, we have, I think, much more empathy for Satchel. We spent a lot more time with him. You know, he seems like a good kid who's stuck in this situation. And at least he's got someone looking out for him, but we kind of feel for him. He's actually probably one of the characters we might genuinely have, we care about on the series at all. Which, again, is not a knock on the series. It's kind of indicative, not just of Fargo, it's that Coen Brothers thing where, you know, you might like characters, but you might not necessarily, quote unquote, care about them very much. With the trade, we've spent all the time with Satchel, not that much time with, I guess they call him Zero. And when you do see him, there's nothing wrong. He just seems like a typical kid who seems a bit oblivious to what's going on. You know, he wouldn't mind some cake, but there's not much else to him.
Well, that's what I was thinking. Like, is the writer joke that his name is literally Zero because there's zero time spent on him? And if anybody cares about his storyline, the joke is let him eat cake, because that's really all he's done is eat cake.
All right, we're ending the podcast now. We need not go any further. Just to win time. Anyway, I hate myself. The bulk of the episode is really it's Loy and Josta basically moving pieces around, and we're seeing the effects of it. I mean, there's a little bit outside of that. We did get some Arietta time here this week. Question: there's that moment we see. It's after she's had her meeting with Dr. Harvard, where he's gotten that the letter that Etherito was writing in the previous episode. And thank God he didn't mention who wrote it or anything, kept it anonymous, whatever. But we see her in the room with the patient who's groaning from his bout with gout, whatever. And she starts banging her head against the wall. We saw her in that brief moment in the previous episode. The one time we saw her was she was banging her head against the wall. So I'm wondering, it's like, so is that what she's been doing this whole time while she's been sitting in that room? Was there a time displacement thing here? Or are we just showing that this has been her reaction, just having to sit in that room with the guy with gout, but now that it's not just having to deal with him groaning, but now she's got, you know, the words echoing in her head from that letter, which pretty much drives her to presumably kill off the guy with gout by the end? I guess that's what was happening here.
Yeah, I think there's when she comes out and smiles, she's ended his suffering, quote unquote.
Oh, absolutely. But, that goes without saying.
But I think she comes becomes a little unsure of things. And when she goes in and convinces Dr. Harvard to take her side, I think then she gets her confidence back and goes in and feels confident enough to act on that patient. So I would say those are two different time periods. And I would say that the first time she's become a little unsure, Etherita has started poking around her house. She got, you know, a little flustered to the point she made the pie for them. And if you think about it, like, she made the pie and nobody's ever come over and confronted her about it.
Right.
So I'm sure she was a little off her bearings. But then she went in and had this confrontation with Dr. Harvard. And I think it's funny that when he starts mansplaining to her, she just sort of zones out and she's focused on that letter. And the question I had was, I mean, I think they clearly are signaling she's either going to get that letter because she sees exactly where he sees it. She wants to look at it. But there was a shot that I wondered if when she looked at it, she had a suspicion it was written by Ethelreda, but I don't recall her being privy to Ethelreda's handwriting.
No, I don't think there would be a reason she would have seen her handwriting before, unless I'm forgetting something. But by the same token, Ethelreda would be the most likely suspect because it's someone who's been in her house. And she doesn't
look right.
And how else would anyone know about any sort of keepsakes that she would have? I kind of thought the thing with her banging her head, because I did believe that these are two different things. And when we briefly saw her in the previous episode, this was Arietta the consequence of Arietta restraining herself, because to put it mildly, she's unstable, you know.
Right.
Or insane, whatever you want. But now, you know, she's gotten this new position in, quite frankly, a better hospital, as we know from what happened with the Don in the very first episode. Because Dr. Harvard, it's a highfalutin place now. And I think she's, because of what had happened, she's restraining her urges to deal with situations. Because if this had been, you know, old Arietta, the guy with the gout wouldn't have lasted more than a day. Because she would have been, regardless of the fact you're not going to die from it, she's still, you know, an angel of mercy, putting him out of his pain and also getting rid of an annoyance for her. And I thought this was, when we saw her before, this is what happens when she can't act out on her urges and she's, you know, just, she's literally banging her head against the wall.
Yeah.
And I think that letter and how she's able to deal with Harvard, you know, I think that combined with that just sets her off and she finally acts on her urges. And now we see, oh, look, she's all happy again, you know, because this is kind of what she needs. Maybe I'm talking about that because I've watched Dexter recently. So I've got this thing about, you know, just watching an episode with serial killers talking about acting out on their urges and not being able to show restraint, whatever. So, you know, it kind of fits right into that psychology, I guess.
Yeah, I could see that. And it's kind of a funny parallel between her and Otis because, you know, Otis has his tics to try to control his situation. And that's sort of her tick to try to, I think, take her mind off her desire to act.
Yeah, I would not be surprised if at some point in the remaining five episodes, if there's some point where we see her maybe at home or somewhere else, doing something else that would be similar to the banging the head against the wall. I'm not saying it'll be specifically that again, but something else of a kind of a repeated self-destructive motion or action or something like that. If not, then not. But that's my weird little prediction, which isn't really much of a prediction at all. Otis. Interesting of watching a character who's caught between, you know, he's not just caught between a rock and a hard place. He's, you know, can you be caught between two different rocks and a hard place, or one rock and two hard places? Because you know, he's got multiple problems, not just two. Because he's you know, obviously he's going back and forth between the issues with Loy now, which, you know, have come out of nowhere for him. Not out of nowhere, because he did, you know, he started it by storming the warehouse and everything, as well as Josto. And meanwhile, he still has Deffy following him around. Because Deffy is... wasn't there a shot or two of him watching what was going on? Because I feel like I saw that.
Deffy sees Loy's men leave Otis's place.
Yes, there we go.
He's in his car. You know, he's obviously on to Otis, and he sees them leave. And, you know, I sort of put... You know, Deffy and Ethelreda were sort of the sideline characters in this episode that we just saw a very little bit about that we don't come back to. And, you know, we see Deffy watch Otis. We see Ethelreda return home. And we do see the ghost again when she's blowing out her candles at the, you know, very beginning in the background behind her. And they sort of sideline those and we go off and follow Otis. And I will say, you know, I thought if this is in print somewhere tomorrow, you heard it here first. But I wrote this down. I said, Otis is caught between a rock and a Schwartzman.
So that's $200 for two people I don't foresee ever starring in a movie together. The Rock and Schwartz.
No, caught between A Rock, Chris Rock.
Oh, I get it. All right. So if you enjoyed this. You're pushing me. You know, dude, the only reason this podcast is still recording is because I want to hear the other. I want you to tell us about the other Coen Brother movie references in the episode. Otherwise, people would be like going, wait a minute. I thought they were going to do 3-hour podcast, 22 minutes. The dream is alive.
Well, the second Coen Brothers reference is when Otis is attacked with the shower curtain, which is a callback to Fargo. So that's the first one. And one of the two sort of fake out deaths that happen in the episode is his, where you think, is this really the end for Otis? Turns out it's not. And then there's also the fake out death of Gaetano, where you think he's been killed when Swanee shoots him. So that's the second one, is Otis. And then we obviously see Otis put in motion by both sides.
Right. Hand it to Loy. He did use the two women in a way that they never would have seen coming. I mean, not just to go shoot up this place or that place. He sent them to get Gaetano, of all people. The one who would least likely to see it coming from, like, two women. And I will admit that there was that moment, even though I knew there's no way they were killing off Gaetano that quickly or easily. I mean, no way that we'd be tricked that much by Holly. But part of me was like, oh, that would be kind of cool. But I was like, no, you kind of need him. You need to have him around. You need some more with him. It would be kind of a cheat if we got rid of him at this point. So, but that will be satisfying when they do. Presumably, when he does meet his maker at some point. Do you think it's going to be? Is Deffy going to be the one who kind of is the hero at the end of this, or is Ethel Rita going to somehow factor into that as well? Perhaps, because I guess they're like the two quote-unquote positive characters that we're following. I mean, Deffy does have his certain issues, which we can chalk up to the times or his upbringing if we want, but he's still, at least he's got a code, at least he's got honor. Well, Loy does to a certain degree as well, but he's still, at the end of the day, he's still a bad guy. So
yeah. I think, Deffy's gonna... Ethel Rita, I think there will be more interaction based on them having already interacted. I think we'll see them again. Deffy's definitely the way they've given him an air of competence and seeing through what's going on. I mean, I think he'll play a big role. And I will say, when Gaetano was shot, that was the third Coen Brothers reference, in that we have an obvious allusion to the Big Lebowski with them picking up and taking the rug to get him out of the. I mean, there's a very intentional shot of them rolling up the rug.
When they can't
carry Gaetano out. So, and I thought it was a nice commentary too, that you see Gaetano look out the window when a car arrives, and when he sees it's women, he doesn't think twice, and he's at ease. Now, I have a question for you. When he shot through the door, did you for a minute think maybe he'd killed Calamita?
That didn't occur to me. I mean, it makes sense now that you say it, but that thought hadn't occurred to me. Granted, I was a little bit groggy at this point while I'm watching the episode, but I'm pretty sure I don't recall that occurring to me. So.
I wondered that, because they obviously lingered on that shot, for suspense. And I wondered if it would be Calamita. We see clearly it's not, but I had just wondered if it had been Calamita at the time it happened. So,
okay. Perhaps if I watch it again, maybe I would say, oh yeah, I can see that. But right now I don't recall having that thought. So that might be more... That might be more based on my denseness right now than not just not thinking in that direction. I'm tired. So, okay, what aspect have we not touched upon at this point? Haven't we talked about the... I mean, again, the rabbi makes the right call and the decision where putting the boy ahead of everything else.
I was going to say, I really like that what you see is what you see him say is that I'm going to give you something I never had a choice.
Right.
And that his allegiance to Satchel isn't because of Loy, isn't because of the Fadas. It's because Satchel is him all over again and is a good kid and he wants to give him a choice. And my thought process is this, is that as they make their way away, that it would make sense that Satchel would want to go back to his family. But if Loy kills Zero, is that why Satchel doesn't come home?
Right.
Because he can't. Because, it, you know, or if they're wiped out. And I will say that there was an interesting thing. It made me look up Sugar Ray Robinson, you know, the boxer that Loy talks to Gaetano about, lost his first bout ever to, do you know who he lost to, his first loss?
Marciano?
Nope.
Oh.
Jake LaMotta.
Oh, LaMotta. I got them confused. Yeah, LaMotta.
Yeah, Jake LaMotta, obviously, you know, revered in the Italian community so much so, Scorsese made a movie, De Niro played, you know, LaMotta in Raging Bull. Yeah, I know you know that. But you know, if that's who Loy is, that a harbinger that eventually Loy's first loss is going to come to the Italians, that if he gets too cocky and, you know, and also Gaetano, you've already referred to as a bull,
right?
And his character's like a bull, so you know, possible. Possible portends bad things for Loy. So, I thought that was an interesting thing. And just for, you know, the heck of it, I looked up some of Sugar Ray Robinson's stats right after it was over. And in 1950, Sugar Ray Robinson fought 19 times. And I can't imagine somebody fighting 19 times in a year. You know, the violence of that era and what it would mean now, if, you know, fighters fight what, once a year, if that.
Right.
Once so,
yeah.
Oh, well, yeah.
Well, that was also back when people actually cared about boxing and, you know,
right. Exactly. Something.
As somebody now who's the heavyweight champion, I don't think anybody knows.
Right. Sugar Ray Robinson and LaMotta was, you know, it was that old story of, you know, the black guy against the great white hope. And, you know, in one of their fights, LaMotta was praised even though he lost because Sugar Ray Robinson couldn't knock him down. And so just some interesting historical facts that looking at it, you know, the intention of putting that in that scene just made me want to look at it. So I thought I would share those facts.
And also going with what you said in a previous episode, which I'm jealous you said it because I would have wish I could have said it, but you said it. I think it's a fairly clear call that by the time this is all over, pretty much hardly anybody's going to be left standing, which therefore will then leave Satchel with the rabbi, and they go off on their own, which then explains the whole Milligan last name leading to Mike Milligan, etc., which makes perfect sense in that regard. So, again, Loy talking that way about Sugar Ray Robinson, yeah, that feels like a bit of foreshadowing there of what will eventually happen to him. But I tend to think that we may witness the wipeout of both families by the end of this, pretty much. Maybe a UFO will show up, you know, because, you know, it's Fargo. So. It's possible. Maybe David from Legion will show up and wipe them all out. You know, crossover.
Crossover.
I wouldn't put it past them. Wait, have the Coen brothers dealt with aliens? Yeah, let's go take a look. Anyway.
And I will give you a shout out. there was a fact in this episode that I thought you would probably really appreciate. And that is that, that Otis's, you know, one little, two little, three little Indians is expanded on. And when he's super stressed, it becomes audible in his head when he's going to get, Satchel. And, they really expanded on that. And you'd picked up on that before and mentioned it.
Oh yeah. And that's one of those songs I remember when I was a kid. One little, two little, three little Indians, four little Indians, 10 little Indian boys. Probably why I really was a big fan of Agatha Christie and the 10 Little Indians thing. Not the original version of the poem, because that would be inappropriate. So anyway. I assume, well, I know, obviously you know what I'm talking about.
I do.
Yeah. And yeah, folks out there don't know what I'm talking about. Well, you know, maybe you're better off. But the original version of the poem, 10 Little Indians, it's not Indians. If you think Indians is not politically correct or whatever nowadays, the original word would be the epitome of not being politically correct or even, you know. Anyway, let me see. Was there anything else that we would have liked to have touched on with this one? I mean, it's interesting how you've mentioned a few times, both before we recorded and then I think even during this podcast, how... It's funny how it's because it's Fargo and what they've been doing, especially this season, that we're going to refer to an episode that's actually a normal length for an episode as a short episode.
Yeah.
Even though, although technically it went to 10, it went a couple of minutes past. So it was still a little bit over. It was like 10 because my DVR sets it. It taped it like for a minute, an hour and 3 minutes or something. And I remember going, ooh, that's nice. Because I'm so used to it being like 11:30 when it's going to be over. And we were finished just a little after 11. But that's typical. It's like, oh yeah, a short episode is a normal length episode. But most of the time this season, it's been like an hour and 15, hour and 20 minutes each.
Yeah, and the pace of this, and so just so I think you and I are in agreement on this, I think what we see is the cracks in the story structure certainly aren't throwing off the pacing. I mean, the pacing of this episode was brisk. The hour went by very quickly, and it's hit that stride where, you know, I want the next episode right now. Because I want to see what's happening. We're at the start of the war. Some bodies dropped, and things are happening fast. What I think right now, you and I have a picture of what's going to happen. The thing that neither you or I foresee, and probably the pieces we want to see fixed, may end up being Deffy, Ethelreda, and Orietta. How those things all fit into the story.
Right. They're, because everything else is pretty much a mob story. They're the wild cards in the mix that can really, you know, influence or change, you know, what may otherwise be a predictable outcome. So I am intrigued to see where that goes. I'm definitely enjoying it. I mean, totally. I'm probably enjoying it as far as just, you know, the escalation and the pacing, perhaps in a lot of ways more than I enjoyed season three. Even if season three did have a couple really great standout characters, they just didn't turn out to be the main characters in season three. The thing that hurts the show a little bit, and I would actually go as far as say this is, again, indicative of the Coen brothers' work itself, is, and I won't say it's the case with every Coen brothers movie, that would be too wide a brush, whatever. But generally speaking, for the most part, they're beyond the technical aspects of Coen brothers movies, which are usually very beautifully shot, cinematography, whatever, and the fun plotting of the scripts, you know, and the dialogue, whatever. But you rarely really care that much about the characters. I'm not saying that that's the case with every single character in every single Coen brothers. That's not true. But I would say it's more often the case than not. I mean, you it's more often you just think of the couple standouts, but generally speaking, you know, they're all cannon fodder, so to speak. You know, you know, like you go back to the original Fargo. I mean, Marge and her husband, as far as my immediate recollection, are the only people that I would actually say I would quote unquote care about in that movie. I certainly don't care about anyone else. I mean, I'm enjoying watching like Steve Buscemi's presence and whatever, but I could care less if he gets killed or not in that movie, other than the fact that, oh no, we're going to lose a great performance. Or everyone. It's a lot of great performers, but you don't tend to actually really care about them. But also, they're also exploring the more the dark side of people, in which case you probably are going to be less inclined to care. You know, so just the way you've gone with each season of this series, you know, the two focal points in season one, you know, we don't really like or care about them, but we're fascinated by them. We like the main cop, but we don't care about much of anybody else. Same with season two. Did anyone really like, what's her name? Well, I can't remember the characters' names off the top of my head for some reason, but Kirsten Dunst and Jesse Plemons, again, great performances, you know, fun to watch. Do I actually like them at all? No. Do I actually care about them at all? No. But I'm fascinated by them, and I'll watch them. And same with all the different, what do you call it, the gangster families that we're dealing with in that season as well. So on and so forth. It's very indicative of their work. And again, I do not mean this as a criticism, but that's the template they've created for this show. And even a season like this, which is different than the first three in a lot of ways, it still has that same feeling where, you know, I might be interested or fascinated or compelled or find a character compelling. I can't say I actually care about the character. Then I have to decide, do I care that I don't care? No, I don't care.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And I think that's sort of the inherent in the conversations we've had about, you know, we actually did find this character we really like, Dr. Senator, and because of the construct of this show, we sort of suspected he was on the chopping block, and he was. That's
right.
I think in most you know, Coen Brothers things, it's about the story and not about the characters so much. I mean, the characters are developed, but not in the way where the character's first and the story comes second. It's the story's first and the character's second in Coen Brothers stuff, usually.
Yes. Yeah, I would agree with that. They don't tend to do character study pieces, although they have, because I don't want people, not that anyone really bothers to comment either on our Facebook page or anywhere else. I already have a few Coen Brothers in mind that buck that trend that I can think of, even though I would point out, yes, they do dip into character study and character development a few times, but I'll still say I don't like the character, or I don't care. I shouldn't say don't like that. I hate when people go on whether they like her, because it's a different thing to like a character or to care about them. I distinguish between the two. Other people might not, but I do. I can like a character, but I don't care about the character.
Absolutely.
I can like Tyler Durden in Fight Club, you know, but I don't care about him, you know.
Right. Well, let's be honest. Okay. I mean, if somebody wants to come at us about, you know, this criticism of this season, when the families are named Cannon and Fada, and one of the kids named Zero, the doctor's named Dr. Harvard. I mean, you know, like we've already said, you know, a lot of the conceit of the names of these characters is absurdist in its very nature.
Yes.
So, I mean, it's the story that's served. So, you know, hey, if you want to come at us with the comments, feel free. But that's just how we see it. And yeah, as Scott said, if you don't like it, get your own podcast. So,
all right, that was.
Oh, and let me say before we sign off, it wouldn't do justice talking about the Coen Brothers world, which we find fascinating and enjoy, and by no means mean to crap on. But let's send a shout out for the dude Jeff Bridges. Got some, you know, news on the cancer front. So from the Coen verse, let's wish for healing for the dude.
Oh, absolutely. A couple nights ago, I was contemplating, despite my foot injury, I was trying to decide, will I be able to make it and go out to a local establishment of a drinking nature that is allowing people to be inside, whatever. We're not going to get into that whole aspect of it. But to go out for Halloween. Because part of me is thinking, hey, you know, nurse your foot, stay home. You don't want to be waltzing around out there. And one of the two ideas I did have, and went as far as items were in my cart on Amazon, and then I took them out. One of them was, because that way I could keep the beard. One of them was a Moses idea, because I just liked the idea of having a staff I could use as a cane the whole night. And the other one was the dude, finally, because I had never done that before. And I was looking, and you can really get some really cool stuff to get yourself done up as a dude, except I didn't like the whole sweater and pants thing that he wore. You can get that as a costume. But I was really looking hard, and I had it in my cart, the bathrobe. And I was thinking, the bathrobe and the wig, I'll keep the beard, even though he's got more of a big goatee and not the full thing, but I can get away with that. It's like, oh, can I go as a dude? That'd be kind of funny. You know, even though I'll have a big stupid surgical boot on, but the dude hurt his foot. It's okay. And then at the last minute, it's like, dude, no, don't be spending $100 on this crap. No, stop it. Stop. If you feel compelled to go out on October 31st, break out the old hazmat suit that you know from Breaking Bad. It's a COVID year. You could totally get away with that in the gas mask. Be perfect.
That's not a bad plan.
Hopefully I'll just sleep. Okay, so I guess that is pretty much it. Oh, by the way, I just love the whole I was cooking my belt that he had already eaten his shoes. I just love that part of his story.
That's just, yeah, that's great.
Yeah. I just love that. All right, then. So we are definitely going to be looking forward to next week's episode. I'm curious. Now you got me curious how long that episode will be. Will it be another hour and 3 minutes, or will they go back to their hour and a half, or maybe it will be a 12-minute episode? Remains to be seen. All right. So, hey, kids out there, if you enjoyed listening to our podcast, guess what? You'll probably enjoy hanging out on our podcast page even more. It's the Serious TV Drama Podcast page. Like the page and join the conversation about shows like Fargo and pretty much any show you can think of. Right now, you might be able to talk about some of the greatest TV shows of all time. I'll get to that in a minute. Anyway. You can also track us down on Apple Podcasts, subscribe to our feed, and you can rate and review us there. Although it might be really complicated. It took me like a year and a day to freaking find our ratings and reviews on thing. And it's like, we've got 45 five-star ratings. It's like, we have 44 five-star ratings and 1 one-star rating. I love that.
it's the East German judge.
I just love that one. It's still my favorite review we ever got. The one really bad one, and the one episode that I didn't produce or did. Anyway, it's not her fault. What else? You can go to the podcast hosting page to check out all 279. Episodes of this here podcast. You go to stvdpodcast.podbean.com. And finally, you can follow us on Twitter. Our Twitter account has been oddly active this week. So it's starting to become worth it. I'm hoping for comments from either Ryan Reynolds or Rhea Seahorn. Let's put it that way. Anyway, you can follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is at STVD Podcast. That's STVD as in Serious TV Drama. Now, obviously, or maybe not so obviously, Brian and I will be back a week from tonight to talk about the next episode of Fargo. I should also mention, as I've mentioned before, there is another series of podcasts that we are putting out here at the STVD Factory that has been titled The Greatest TV Drama Episodes of All Time. Hopefully some of you, if not all of you, have checked out the very first one that came out this week, which was because it's taking a countdown-like format. So it was number 20. It was an episode of House. I believe it was the 15th episode of season 4, titled House's Head, I was joined by Kelly from the Geek Girl Soup podcast, and guess what? It turned out to be a really good podcast, and we are gearing up for our next episode, which will be released later this, at the end of this week. That one, since I revealed it at the end of that podcast, I can mention it here as well. I will be joined by Jamie, who y'all know from appearing oftentimes over the last year. And good Lord, we're going to be talking about, it's another season 4 episode. See, I have this thing about season 4s of shows. Season 4 is usually the season for most shows. I'm telling you. It's season 4 of Dexter. Good Lord. That's right. Dexter. We are going to be talking about the season finale of Dexter. The greatest episode of Dexter. The last good episode of Dexter, maybe. We don't know. We'll see what we say when you hear our podcast. So look for that one. That will be number 19. That will be released the day before Halloween. How appropriate, you know, a show about a serial killer being released on Halloween weekend.
Perfect.
And that's about it. And if there are folks out there who are barely tolerating me, but they're fans of my man Brian here, Brian will be joining me for probably more than one of these, but in a few weeks he will be joining me for one. I just can't tell you what the show is because that's my rule. But I'm sure.
Stay tuned.
Yeah, stay tuned. Yeah. Watch the skies. Anyway. People are like, why is he saying that? Anyway, that's it. And oh, look, Duty wants me to stop recording. So, Brian, once again, thank you so much for joining me on our trip through, well, by way of Kansas City, our trip to Fargo again this week.
That was great, Scott. I'll see you next week.
All right. I'll see you soon. Good night to you and good night to everybody else out there.